The St. Augustine Institute of Catholic Studies presents Brother Francis with his regular Tuesday night lecture. This is Tuesday, April 23rd, 1984. Brother Francis.
Father, and of the Son, and of the Holy Ghost. Amen. I want to start tonight by reading you a short passage from Isaiah the prophet. He says, "Let the wicked forsake his way, and the unjust man his thoughts, and let him return to the Lord, and he will have mercy on him, and to our God, for he is bountiful to forgive. For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor your ways my ways, saith the Lord. For as the heavens are exalted above the earth, so are my ways exalted above your ways, and my thoughts above your thoughts." So God gave us the sky as a symbol to realize how infinitely higher he is above us. And wisdom is an attribute of God, properly belongs to God. Even the pagans started to call themselves wise, and then when they really realized what wisdom was, they became humble, and they started to call themselves lovers or seekers after wisdom. And that is the meaning of the word philosophy. It's a lover of wisdom. I told you the definition of wisdom at the start of the course, and I will repeat it for you tonight. Wisdom is the most perfect knowledge of the most important truths in the right order of emphasis, accompanied by a total, permanent disposition to live accordingly. And the true wisdom is the wisdom that God gave us, the truths by which we make our way to the beatific vision, the truths of salvation. And these truths, no human being contributed one iota to. They all came from God. But still, since grace builds on nature, there are things we can do to prepare the grounds to be more receptive. And one of the most sublime and effective ways by which we can prepare the grounds for God's wisdom to come to us and take root in us is the discipline of philosophy. It's only in that spirit that we do it. And any time that it is not leading us to a greater knowledge and love of God and to the manner of life that becomes increasingly more contemplative, we better leave it alone. So that, in brief, is our program. I have asked myself the question once, and it's the question that everybody was asking me, and so I sat down and made a few points of meditations on it. And that's the one point that I will give you tonight as a meditation. Why philosophy? The most common answer to it today is, why indeed? Let's get rid of it. And today, philosophy does not exist in our colleges. Whatever substitutes they give for it are the very opposite. They deserve to be called more sophistry than philosophy. They are distractions, they are fake substitutes. Instead of elevating the mind and making it more capable to have a deeper realization of the spiritual, whatever they are teaching today is doing the exact opposite. But we say, yes, philosophy is necessary and is, will always be part of our crusade. And I say confidently that the reason that our crusade has lasted as it has, and every day we are still in existence and have not given in, have not compromised, by God's grace, it is a miracle and is a victory and is a great achievement. I say, why philosophy? First, because philosophy is natural to man to raise the questions and to try to answer them. The questions of philosophy are the most natural questions every man, when he begins to think, must raise. It proceeds from man's essence as a rational being. When sound philosophy is not cultivated, false and subversive philosophies invariably arise. So that's one point you can think about. Two, because all man's activities and achievements in art, science, government, you can add education, you can add anything else you want, or any other field of civilized work, proceed from thought as from their proper principle, and can therefore be subverted by bad thinking about fundamental matters. This is precisely the province of philosophy. Three, because there is in history a tradition of true philosophy. What do we call it in Latin? Philosophia perennis. And by uniting our minds to this tradition, we achieve unity with the best minds of other ages and other countries. What a communion we have with St. Francis of Sales, with St. Thomas Aquinas, St. Augustine. Every one of them raised and thought and meditated very deeply on all the fundamental problems that we are occupying ourselves with. We join in the common effort of humanity to seek, attain, and preserve the higher values. We live in an age in which we see the collapse of values. That's a subject I could start and never finish. How many values we see collapsing around us every day. Because true philosophy prepares the mind for God's revelations and serves to expound and to defend the faith, on which account it is called, in Latin, what do we say? Ancilla Theologiae, the handmaid of theology. Without solid philosophic foundations, both piety and morality become superficial, unstable, and ineffective. Five, because the spirit and method of philosophy save the mind from the narrowing effects of the scientific method, which is excessively dominant today in education. There is a place for science, but it is certainly being put completely out of its place. And from its hasty and unwarranted conclusions, so often opposed to faith and to proper order, philosophy upholds the reality of the spiritual, the primacy of the contemplative over the pragmatic, and restrains against the scientific tendencies towards materialism and other forms of monism. Six, because sound philosophy is one of the weapons used in the evangelization of the nations, involving, as it does, a common human value. When you speak about wisdom, wherever you go in the world, you find a response. Nobody tells you, what are you talking about? It's somehow one of those things that were very precious in the mind of our common father, Adam. And while many of the traditions that were given to Adam or that he attained in a wrong life of penance and dedication and devotion, so that he deserves to be commemorated in the martyrology on the eve of Christmas, many of these traditions have become distorted. Yet one of the values that somehow survived all the thousands of years that have come since is the value of wisdom. Every nation or people, no matter how far removed, no matter how, you might call, savage in their manners, they all know what you mean when you say wisdom. And when we say, it is our duty constantly to seek wisdom. I will be going to thoughts like that every week for a while as continuing my introduction. I didn't feel that I completely satisfied what I intended to do in those introductory lectures. But since logic itself is in the nature of an introduction to philosophy, that's what it is, especially minor logic, and that's going to be our course now, I will continue to study philosophy in general while we are learning our minor logic. I would like to have a textbook in your hands to give you a chance a little bit to refer to it during the week, to do a little outside, out-of-class study. It's not absolutely necessary. If you pay good attention here, don't go to sleep on me, even when I deserve it. I think you will get enough of what is meant to be achieved by this course. But some of you who would like to do it a little more in a more academic way, it will be helpful if you have in your hand a textbook. And we might be able to provide sheets or something. We have been talking about it, and I'll let you know more next week. You know now that the first thing we study in philosophy is minor logic. And minor logic is defined as, I told you the definition before, let us review it: the science and art of correct reasoning. In all science, we reason. In logic, we reason about reason. That's why we say we let the mind reflect on its own activities. We try to think about how we think. And what do you mean by correct reasoning? What makes one kind of reasoning or thinking correct and the other one incorrect? If you see a man walking, you know he has in mind some place that he wants to go. Is there anything more ridiculous than to ask a man, where are you going? Say, I don't know. Once he knows, when he doesn't know where he's going, there's no such thing as losing the way. But if he's trying to go somewhere, well, then he can lose the way. And then you say he's in error. He took the wrong road. Now, where are we going when we reason? We are going towards the truth. Correct reasoning is the reasoning that keeps us in the truth. And when we start reasoning correctly, we fall into error. The truth, again, I gave you its definition once before, and I think some of you still know it. Truth is the conformity of the mind to reality. The conformity of the mind to reality. If I say it is snowing outside, if I think in my mind it's snowing outside, I will be in error. because you go outside and it's not snowing. It's just as simple as that. But of course, here we are concerned with the deeper truths. What would be the greatest error a mind could make to deny that there is a God? That there is a God, that's the first truth, and immediately it brings with it all kinds of obligations, of realizations, of it is the beginning of contemplating. Once you know that there is a reality that's God, you want to be as close to it, to know more about it, as you possibly can. What's another truth where the mind could be in complete disconformity with what is? To deny the immortality of the soul. And how common that is today. There is something about man that very few would come out and deny the existence of God. I mean, even though they live like they don't believe in God, they still somehow with their lips affirm it. But how many people today truly believe that they are going to live forever, and that every person they know, every human being they know, is also going to live forever? That's a tremendous truth. And when the mind gets to be materialistic and starts to take the wrong turn on every road and get into science in the wrong way, before you know it, immortality vanishes. Another tremendous truth is the liberty of the will, that man is free. If man is not free, he is not morally responsible. So to know that we do make free, responsible choices, that's a tremendous foundation. And that's another truth that so much of modern science is completely undermining. When you study Freudianism, you wonder in the end if there is any freedom at all. I mean, even when you think you are making a decision, some unconscious something going on, that the subconscious is causing things, and you think you are making decisions that you are not responsible. A great deal of pleading in the courts today is based on this false psychology. It's a crazy thing. Nobody is responsible for anything. To deny the identity of substance, because if you deny the identity of substance, you deny the identity of person, and a person that's in the being held responsible for a crime that he committed last week, where you say it's a different thing. Why talk about it? I mean, it is a different thing that did it. So all these fundamental values can be undermined, are being undermined, and as a result is the terrible decadent at the most charitable thing you can say, civilization in which we live. At its best, decadent; at its worst, degenerate. And it all begins with bad thought, misdirected thought that has not used the powers that God gave it for the purpose for which God gave those powers. So we reflect on our own thinking. We find that when we think, the mind can be reduced to three acts. And therefore, in minor logic, we study those three acts. And what are the three acts? That's something that should be remembered and easy to remember. One corresponds to idea, one corresponds to judgment, one corresponds to reasoning. That's all that the mind does, the intellect. It gets ideas, then it forms judgments, then it goes from one judgment to another judgment, and that we call reasoning. And so our course in minor logic is going to be about these three acts of the mind. The first, or the simplest of them, is the act by which the mind gets ideas. I have a checklist here of slightly technical terms. My list tonight is 10. And I think before I finish, I will have used every one of them and somehow tried to define it. And when I finish, I will go over the checklist and see if we still remember how we use them. Every discipline, every science, every art, even in sports, you have to have some technical terms. If you didn't know some of the technical terms, Jim is constantly trying to teach me some of the terms for baseball, and he won't even know. You'll just be there. You don't even know what's going on. So there is no human discipline of any sort that doesn't require somewhat a new terminology. So does philosophy. With this difference, most of the technical terms in philosophy are very ordinary terms. Only the philosopher uses them with a certain refinement. There will be very rare occasions when I will introduce a word like osmosis or oxidation or something that you'll find in some other science. But in philosophy, it's terms that you think you know, but you wait to see how the philosophers have clearly defined it. So one of them is the word idea. So what do we mean by an idea? I will give you a few synonyms for it. Another synonym for idea is concept. With our thought, immediately language comes in. When thought is merely thought, it's there in a box here, and only God and the angels know what's going on. But when we start exchanging ideas, when we start conversing and communicating, we have to translate the activities of thought into language. And so the concept or the idea become the word. So all these are almost equivalent terms, all connected with the idea that we'll be talking about now. The manner by which the mind gets an idea. Some bad philosophies tell you we start with all kinds of ideas in our head. Sound philosophy, Philosophia Perennis, said no, we don't. The mind begins as what they say, tabula rasa, a blackboard all erased. There's nothing on it except capability of receiving, because it's essential to that marvelous reality that is knowledge, that prior to the object presenting itself to be known, the power that receives it is completely neutral. It has no story ahead of time. It's waiting for the story to be told. So it's a very important thing to know that fact. The mind begins as a tabula rasa, Latin for a blackboard all erased, completely neutral. The eye, we always can go from the intellect, which is a spiritual power, to the powers that God gave us for knowledge of the material things, in the material order. And we have a more direct experience of those. If the eye began seeing everything yellow before the object presented itself, you know, it's sick. The perfect eye as an organ of knowledge, of sense knowledge, is one that has absolutely no color of itself, awaits for the object to convey its color, you see? And the same thing with the mind. The mind is receptive of what is. One of my favorite maxims that Sister Mary Bernadette reminded me of this week, when I read it, I get so excited. It was a statement made by the great doctor of the church, Saint Hilary. He said, truth is declarative being. That's all I wanted to know. truth is declarative being. Everything that is has a tendency to declare what it is to a power capable of receiving what it is. That's knowledge. And we will see that the foundation of this fact, this is part of that general principle which I have raved about several times and will continue to increasingly. There is a predilection in all existence, in all reality, for the fact of knowledge. What is intelligible, as the philosophers say, is knowable, but that is really looking at it passively. It's not only knowable, it's eager to be known. And every power that's capable of knowing is eager to receive that knowledge. As a matter of fact, even if the fact is in itself unpleasant, if it is a fact, it's better that you know it than that you be ignorant of it. Supposing one of my relatives died. I don't want my relatives to die, but I would rather know that it is so than go on living in a fool's paradise thinking that they are living when they are not. There is a tremendous predilection in all reality for knowing what is. And everything that is eager to deliver itself in knowledge. The child begins by receiving knowledge in a process the philosophers call simple apprehension. And simple apprehension is that by which ideas start coming out of the sense experiences. When the child says moon, he doesn't tell you it's beautiful or it's sublime or he doesn't write poetry about it. But an idea has just flashed in the mind. Grass, wow, beautiful. Every single concept, once it is flashing in the intelligence that God gave us, simply, that means before you relate one thing to another, you cannot say, when the child says moon, you don't say true, because he hasn't said anything about the moon. To know. If he said the moon is cheese, well, then you say, no, that's not true. But if he just says moon, it's neither true nor false. But it is simple apprehension. It's an idea being taken in. So that's a technical term, simple apprehension. Is it the idea? Well, very closely to being the idea, but it's not the idea. It's the grasping at the idea by the intellect. It's the reception of it. It's the process by which the idea is arising. What's the next step? Judgment. That's when one idea is related to another, and it's only when you make a judgment that the question of true or false can be in question. So I would like to read you from the book that I learned philosophy under Father Carter, and I used his books for many, many years. An idea or concept considered subjectively is an act of the mind by which we conceive something. Considered objectively, it is that which we conceive by such an act. Now, these are two very valuable words. How many times you heard me say that one of the greatest evils of our age is subjectivism? Well, that's where we have the two words arising for the first time in logic. Every idea has two aspects to it. You cannot separate them one from the other. You can't say, let me have an idea without it being having a subjective aspect to it. No ideas just float in the air. It has to be somebody thinking. If there is an idea, there is a mind. If there is a simple apprehension, there is a mind simply apprehending. But there is another aspect to it. What is it apprehending? Now, that's the objective aspect. Do we study the subjective aspect of ideas in minor logic? No, that's the last time you'll hear me talking about that. We know there is a subjective aspect to them, but in my, and we will be interested in that maybe in psychology, even in epistemology, that question will arise again. But in minor logic, we are only interested in the object of thought. That's where the question of truth or no truth is to be found. So we are only interested, but we always know, and that is the scandal of the modern philosophers, knowing that every idea must have a subjective aspect. They then keep the idea merely in that subjective well down there, and they can't get out of that well. And so they end up saying everything we know must be in us, and therefore the whole universe, if I know the sun, but I don't know the sun is out there, and my knowledge is down here. All I know is an idea, and whether there is a sun producing that idea or not, heaven only knows. And that's the way subjectivism comes into the world. The English philosopher, not the English, Irish, the Irish Anglican, if there is such a thing, he was a bishop of the Church of Ireland, Bartley. Es percipi est esse. To be is to be perceived. The thing is only existing when it is being known. So you see now the inversion of values. Now it sounds like a very small sentence, and for a while you can get very excited about it, but after a while you discover how it's the destruction of all objectivity. Esse est percipi. To be is to be perceived. Now, they can say an awful lot in defense of it, so on, but all the time they are swallowing objectivity into the subjective aspect of the idea. So, there is no way of separating those two aspects. But there is an absolute necessity for distinguishing them. He goes on to say, conceiving in scholastic terminology is not the same as seeing with our eyes or hearing with our ears, nor imagining with our imagination, nor may it be used synonymously for any of these acts. Conceiving is an act of the intellect, a spiritual faculty, as will be proved in psychology. The differences will be discussed further also in epistemology. Now, that is the first thing we have to get very clearly straight from the start, to distinguish between the idea and the phantasm. What is a phantasm? It's a sense image. It could have color, it could have sound, it could have tangibility, touch, feeling. It could have all these things get together to form a phantasm, what our inner senses. When I try to remember some definite, concrete Mount Wachusett, try to think of it, I have a phantasm of Mount Wachusett. That's not the idea. What do they have in common? I'm introducing these words without stopping to tell you I'm introducing them, but when I finish, I'm going to go over my checklist to see that we have covered them. Both the phantasm and the idea are media of knowledge. Media, that's the plural of what word? Medium. You speak much about the media today. Now, we study in logic the media. But in the matter of knowledge, there is a kind of medium that's entirely singular and unique and can only occur in knowledge. It's the medium that has no other reality but to convey the object of which it is the medium. Because, and this is one of my favorite sentences, and you will hear me repeat it, so if you didn't get it the first time, you'll get it the 100th time, we don't know our ideas, we know by our ideas, but we know the object. My idea of the sun. I know the sun, and I've been talking about the sun, but then on reflection I know that the sun is part of my thought through a medium. that we call the idea. Now, the phantasm is also a medium of knowledge. Now, what is the difference then between the phantasm and the idea? The phantasm is for sense, what the idea is for intelligence. What's the difference between sense and intelligence? First, what is common to them? You can see difference when you see first what's common. Both involve knowledge. When I look and see that the rose is red, that's knowledge, that's sense knowledge. When I know that the sum of the angles of a triangle is 180 degrees, there's no sense knowledge there at all. That's intellectual knowledge. Sense knowledge is entirely in the material process. What we sense has to be concrete and individual. I can't see the trees of the whole universe. I have to be staring at one definite tree with a definite size, a definite shape, a definite color. That is what makes an impression on me, and with my senses I see it. The organs of the senses have to be material organs. The soul has the power of sight. But when there are no eyes, that power is absolutely useless, cannot be exercised. The soul has the power of hearing. But unless the organ of hearing is there, the soul is completely incapable of hearing. The medium has to be material. Light, air, some medium should be there. The object has to be material. The only thing that could be received by sense is a material object. So get that very clear and straight. And the medium of knowledge in that material, the whole process is material, is completely immersed in matter. The medium for knowledge there we call the phantasm. But when the knowledge occurs in a spiritual power we call the intellect, instead of the phantasm we have the idea. It's still a medium of knowledge, but it is not a sense impression. Now, almost all of Anglo-Saxon philosophy began with thinkers that spent their life trying to deny the distinction between the idea and the phantasm. And what they ended up doing is to give us a heritage of thought that's bound to be sensist in knowledge and therefore materialistic in outlook. And therefore hedonistic in ethics. And they try to make hedonism, which means tearing us into animals like the cows and the pigs and the snakes, that there's nothing that's good except what gives us good feelings, like pleasure, and there's nothing evil except what gives us bad feelings, like pain. And they don't need to be selfish about it. They can be very altruistic, and they could concern about not only their own health, but everybody's health, build more hospitals and so on. I'm not advising not to take care of your health, but I say all values have to have their proper order, and only wisdom teaches us how to put first things first and how to put everything in its proper order. So it's a most essential duty of me as a teacher of minor logic to make sure, if you didn't get it tonight, before the end of the course, you will absolutely be certain that an idea is not a phantasm, and that there is a very essential difference between the medium of knowledge by which we know spiritually, and even about the material world, our knowledge has to be spiritual. Because the idea, the phantasm, is singular, individual. The idea has to be universal. Now they tell you, oh no, we don't have an idea tree. We just have images of trees superposed on each other, and then you end up with some kind of an amalgam, which, you know, could be pine tree or oak tree or a little bush or something. None of that. The idea tree is clear and definite and has absolutely no size. The mind can abstract. And that's its spiritual power. And even when I think about trees, which are very material things, as I become a universal idea in the mind, it's an essence that could be repeated and could have all kinds of different accidents, but the essence is clear and definite. The tree is material, but the idea tree is a spiritual thing and can be received into a spiritual power, the intellect, which has no organ. The intellect is not the brain. The brain is the locus of our inner senses. So that's another difference. The phantasm is somewhere in our brain, in our inner sensitive organs. It's material, bodily. The idea is not. It's something spiritual and immaterial. Now, nobody can deny that ideas like justice were never smelt or touched or seen with the eyes or heard or imagined or any. Nobody can deny that. But when we come to universals which are about material things, like cows and dogs and birds and trees, then they think, you know, that the idea is nothing but the phantasm, and that's wrong. Because in the intellect, when we know intellectually, even our knowledge of material things has to be a spiritual knowledge. So I started talking about the synonyms that go with the word idea. I said idea and concept are synonymous. And you can almost take a book of logic and everywhere idea occur, replace it by concept. Term. When you call it term, our ideas, once they start functioning in judgments, and judgments are expressed in propositions, and not every sentence is a proposition. A command is not a proposition. One quick way to know what's the difference is to say, can you say it is true or false? This is so important. Most people don't even understand what the infallibility of the Pope means because they don't even understand what a proposition is. The infallibility of the Pope can only be exercised when he is given propositions, not when he is given commands. There's no infallibility in commands. It's a question of prudence there. When he says the Blessed Virgin Mary was assumed, body and soul, into heaven, that's a proposition. That could be true and that could be false. But when he says you can now eat meat on Friday, that's a command. There's no proposition there. You see now why we do need to know these little distinctions, even to understand the simple requirements of our knowledge of our faith. So all ideas have to function in the context of prepositions. And two words you hear very often used, and it's good to see clearly how they are used, are the words subject and predicate, because that's what a preposition is. When I say Socrates is mortal, Socrates is the subject of that preposition, and mortal is the predicate. One of the words that confuses everybody studying philosophy is all the words divide from that word predicate. The categories are called the predicamentals, and we have the five predicables, and you keep calling about predication, and people go just dizzy. They say, well, what's he talking about, so on. It's the simplest value that's going. A proposition has to have a subject. We are talking about something. The subject of a science. Supposing the science is the treatise of St. Thomas about man, one of the 36 treatises in the Summa is about man. That means that every proposition in that treatise, its ultimate subject, if not the immediate subject, is man. And when you say man, you are talking about a universal, but what makes that universal real is all the things of which the universal man can be what? Predicated. Because what you can predicate of man as a universal can be predicated of every entity of which you can say Socrates is a man, Peter is a man, Paul is a man, John is a man. In that sense, you can give a girl's name because man there means human nature. Okay? So, subject and predicate, very important. Now, when you call the concept or the idea a term, it means you are talking about it as it's going to function. You are naming it in terms of its function in a proposition. You are already, and also the advantage there is that in that case, you can apply it to the idea as well as to the word expressing the idea. Now let me continue with Father Cutter. The two aspects, the subjective and the objective, are essential to every cognition. Cognition. Does that make you dizzy? What does it mean? Act of knowledge. Cognition is another philosophic word for knowledge. Its advantage is that it functions both for the intellectual, the spiritual level, as well as for the sense level. The feel of touch, that's cognition. Well, I feel what this thing is. That's cognition on the level of touch. So, you cannot have one without the other, just as you cannot have a sale without a purchase. Still, it is impossible to give one definition that will cover both aspects. Their natures differ too much. Logic deals primarily with objective ideas. Ideas as acts of the mind pertain to the subject matter of psychology. The act of conceiving something is also called a simple apprehension. So that's another word, just enshrine it, because we're going to be using it. A little bit of a technical term, but once you know what it means. Simple apprehension is the act of the mind, the process in the mind by which the mind gets ideas. Like white, like green, like grass, like sky, like moon, star. That's the first thing the mind, the child does to indicate its rational nature is to start getting these simple apprehensions, long before he can make sentences expressing judgments. It differs, however, slightly from the idea. Simple apprehension is the process by which we acquire ideas or concepts. Ideas or concepts are the result of such processes. Another pair of two very important terms. You cannot think about thought without knowing them. Every idea has a comprehension and an extension. Now you think you know what extension means, but what you know is not at all what logic talks about. So be careful now and get it. It's simple, but you have to get it clearly at least once. What do we mean by the comprehension of an idea? Most ideas, indeed you are going to find all ideas except one, are composite. You can analyze them into simpler ideas. Take man, that's an idea, right? If it is man, it has to be substance. Have you ever known a man that was just an accident to something else? It's a tree, but accidentally it's man. If it is man, it has to be substance, it has to be living, it has to have sentient powers. Every man has to have sentient powers. It has to be rational. All these substance, living, sentient, rational, these are ideas contained in this composite that is man. What do we refer to them as the, you might compare them to the atoms forming the molecule. What do you call these simpler ideas? Notes. That's another technical term. Now, you use it in music for one reason. You use it when you take notes in class. You use it for other purposes. But now see how the logician uses that word. When the logician says note, he's talking about an idea that is a constituent part of a composite idea. Now, I will surprise you now. There's only one idea that's absolutely simple. Being. The idea being. And not only is it the most... So this is already a preparation for ontology, as you see. Not only is it the simplest idea, It is a note in every other idea. There is no other idea that the mind, even when the mind thinks about nothing, he has to make an instationis, they call it, a being of the mind, and make a being out of nothing, even to be able to think about nothing. So, being. So you know now two properties of what's going to be the subject. When I say the word subject now, does it flash a little light in the mind, not just some vague thing? Everything we study in ontology is about being, but by being about that, which is in every reality that is, but supremely in the supreme reality, we are somehow talking about all things. So the subject of ontology is being. Being is the simplest of all ideas. It is also the note in every other idea. So that's the comprehension. You are taking the concept and analyzing it into its constituent notes. What's the extension of an idea? The extension of an idea is the class of things of which it can be predicated. So that word predicate is coming back, isn't it? So what is the extension of the idea man? It's Brother Francis. It's you. It is you. It's every man that ever was. It's every man that will be born. It's every man that ever lived. Every man living in China or in South Africa or in Brazil, that's the extension of the concept man. If you can point at that and say, this is a man, well then, that you have pointed to is in the class of those things we call the extension of the idea man. Now, one of the first rules of thought is that the smaller the comprehension of an idea, the larger the extension. Do you see why that follows? You take the idea, something living. What's the extension of that? Every dog, every snake, every mosquito, every tree, pine, so on. Every man, something living, see? Add to it sentient, that has sensation, and all the plants drop out, and you are left only with animals and men. Add rational, all the animals drop out, and you have only man. And that is still a very large class, but it's very much smaller than what it started to be. So you contract the idea by adding notes to it, because when you add notes to it, the class to which it can be predicated gets smaller and smaller. So Father Cutter puts it in his lovely German way. He was a German. His name was Cuttermeier, but he simplified it into Cutter. The greater the comprehension of an idea, the less its extension, and vice versa. So I guess I have used my time, so let me go over my checklist quickly to see if I have covered everything that I intended to cover tonight. I had a whole line there, all somewhat synonymous to the word idea. We say there are three parts to minor logic. One part talks about ideas. One part talks about judgments. One part talks about reasonings, the different forms of reasoning, inferences. Reasoning or inferences. So we are going to be for a while in that first part, which talks about ideas. A synonym of idea is concept. Sometimes we call the idea a term, but then we are thinking about it as a function in a proposition. The word simple apprehension refers to the process by which the idea is gotten into the mind. And you remember, the mind starts not with a full bag of ideas, but empty, waiting for being to declare itself. Truth is declarative being. Who said that? Saint Hilary, the doctor of the church, the teacher of Saint Martin, who is the uncle of Saint Patrick. If we have some Irish patriots here, that's good reason for you to know that. truth is declarative being, and being is always declaring, because of the first principle in the Godhead proceeded the Logos. That's the divine reason behind that tremendous fact I've been referring to all along. And that's the kind of thing that fascinated people like St. Bonaventure and even St. Thomas. St. Bonaventure was much more mystical than St. Thomas, but even St. Thomas will finally, through his rational method, arrive at the same conclusion. And then note, which is a constituent part or element in a composite idea. And we get the conclusion that all our ideas are composite except the idea being. And that the idea being is the note in every other idea. That's why we say, I told you I kept ontology to the end, and you thought that why can we leave something that important? Because we were talking ontology all along. You can't talk about anything without talking about ontology. Phantasm. You see now why we contrast the phantasm with the idea. Phantasm is in the material part of us, the senses, what idea is in the spiritual part of us, the intellect. A medium. I will have to take a whole night talking about media, but at least we introduce the notion. The phantasm and the idea are media of knowledge. Media is the plural of medium. We can say mediums, sometimes they do that, but since it is a Latin word, give it a Latin plural. Universal. When the mind apprehends an essence, it apprehends it as a universal. When the senses apprehend a reality, they apprehend it as a concrete individual. That's a tremendous fundamental truth. And many, many philosophers get those two things confused. And when you make a mistake on that level, nothing goes right after that. Everything you say is going to be confused. The comprehension and the extension of an idea, and you know what they mean. The comprehension, you look at the idea as made up of other simpler ideas, composite. The extension is you look to the class of things to which that idea applies, about which that idea can be, what's the word? Predicated. So the word predicate, that means it can be the predicate when the other thing is the subject. Ideas can be considered subjectively and objectively, and in minor logic we consider them objectively. In psychology, we are interested in the subjective aspect. Logic is the science and art of correct reasoning. That's one sentence I hope everybody will always remember. Logic is the science and art of correct reasoning. And correct in what relation? What are we aiming at? Where are we going? Where do we mean to go when we are reasoning? To truth. One of the highest values. There are only two other values on its level, as we shall see later in the transcendental values. Truth. And truth is the conformity of mind to reality. The wise man has cleared himself as much as is possible to man from all error. Predication and what it means. And abstraction. The senses grasp the concrete material individual, the intellect abstracts the universal essence. That's a sentence you can remember from tonight, and it's the last sentence you will hear in this class. In the name of the Father, Son, Holy Ghost, Amen. Hail Mary, full of grace, the Lord is with thee. Blessed art thou amongst women, and blessed is the fruit of thy womb, Jesus. Our Lady, cause of our joy, Our Lady, seat of wisdom. Amen.